thought that there would be this intensity on a holiday, because I was told that when you come and stay at the Tata Center, it's like staying in a 5-star hotel. And I checked out all the little handouts that 5-star hotels give, and I noticed one very substantial difference, and that was that unlike any other 5-star hotel, you are provided here with Dispirin and aspirin. And I think that this is really an indication of...
Yes. When you check out, they don't give you a bill.
Ah, well, that's a major difference. Much pleasanter, this difference than having to follow aspirin. Anyway, yesterday...
Christmas, Merry Christmas to Amanda.
Oh, yes, the gadget. Today I spoke about the constructions and explanations that were provided by European scholars of the Indian past, and we ended up with a few words about Vincent Smith as one of the sort of prime imperialist historians, and I said that today I would then turn to the Indian historians writing on Indian history and see how the story unfolds from this point on. There are really two phases in the writing of Indian history by Indian historians. The first is the phase that begins in the late 19th century, where the writing is substantially on the model provided by the historians, the European historians of the 19th century. Whether it is historians working on the ancient periods, such as the famous Rajendralal Mitra or R.G. Bhandarkar, the general interest is one of continuing the tradition that has been set by people like Cunningham, by Vincent Smith, and other historians who were reconstructing Indian history in the manner in which I described it yesterday. There is, therefore, a continued interest in looking for information and providing information. Very little interest, in fact, in developing interpretations of the information, because it was regarded as substantially the historian's job, largely to provide information and leave it at that. I would like to suggest, at the risk of further provoking you, that there were perhaps two other reasons why many of these early historians, when I say early, I mean from the late 19th century into the early 20th century, did not really bother too much about going into the question of interpreting this information. And these reasons may be one of two or both. One, that the majority of such historians belonged, in fact, to the traditional scribal and literate caste of Indian society. They were substantially Brahmins and Kayas. Largely because, at least with reference to pre-modern Indian history, one did require to have a good knowledge of Sanskrit and Persian. And it was people who were traditionally members of the scribal caste who tended to be the ones who would automatically, from childhood onwards, acquire this kind of expertise which was necessary for looking at the documents which historians consulted for pre-modern history. The other reason, which I think is really the much more important reason, is the whole question of the sociology of education. Remember that all these Indian historians are being trained in universities set up by the British Indian government, and most of these universities are concerned with education as a means of disseminating information. They are not concerned with training people to think critically and analytically about the nature of the government that they were working for or working under. The kind of thing that is associated with a free university system, where really the essence is to try and develop the critical faculty, this is really not something that was uppermost in the minds of the educationists who provided the syllabus for the British Indian university systems in the late 19th century. And consequently, I think that in this broader sociology of education context, one has to consider that most of the people, Indian scholars who took up the writing of Indian history, tended therefore not to ask difficult questions. They were really not concerned with making value judgments about what had been said about the Indian past. They were really behaving much more like technicians who were trained to carry on a particular methodology, which they did with very great success and were extremely well qualified in doing so. The second phase, however, changes. That is, from about the 1910s, 1920s onwards, there is a vast body of Indian historians who are deeply influenced by the national movement, and consequently a lot of their writing of history reflects this concern with a nationalist understanding of the Indian past. There are people like Ojha, Altikar, K.P. Jayaswal, who was actually not a historian, was a lawyer but did a lot of work in history, H.C. Rai Chaudhary, the early R.C. Majumdar, Neelakantha Shastri up to a point, and in other areas, Ramesh Chandra Dutt, who worked substantially on economic history. Now, what is it that the nationalist historians, or what is sometimes these days called the nationalist school of Indian history, what is it that they were concerned with? Let me first of all preface my remarks by saying that there are two types of nationalism, and these two types of nationalism have to be kept clearly in mind when we make generalizations. One is the nationalism that one is familiar with from the tradition of European history, where you have small states coalescing, coming together to form larger states, as in the creation of Germany and in the creation of Italy, the emergence of Great Britain, the emergence of France as nation states. This is a kind of nationalism which, it has been argued, as I said yesterday, was linked quite closely with the process of industrialization that was taking place in Europe and was leading to, as it were, an economic motivation, a technological motivation towards a larger political entity which expressed itself by reaching back into its identity as a nation and emerging as a nation. The other kind of nationalism, equally important in the 19th and 20th centuries, is the nationalism that comes out of a colonial context, and that is that it is colonies under the control of European colonial powers, where there are two prongs to the nationalism. One is anti-colonialism, the getting rid of the colonial power, or at least confrontation with the colonial power, and the other is also linked to the process of industrialization and social change and the emergence thereby of a new category in society, the middle class, which is very closely related to nationalism both in Europe as well as in the colonies. Nationalist historical writing then is historical writing which is influenced by the nationalist ideology and in turn influences and develops further nationalist ideology. This is also tied into the basic emergence of the concept of a nation, which is a new idea. Even in Europe, the concept of a nation state is something which is very much a product of the last couple of hundred years. The historical basis for a nationalist ideology is by no means unique to the Indian situation. It occurs in all colonial situations. It occurs in every Asian society that has been through a colonial phase. It is common to all nationalism. It is a reconsideration of the past in terms of the interests of the new groups that are emerging and in terms of the identity of these new groups. I would like to go back again and again to this question of the link between identity of social groups and historical interpretation, which I think is extremely important. We have seen in the 20th century, for example, a very interesting variation on this, which is that amongst the ex-colonies of Africa and the Caribbean, there was a movement known as Negritude, which is in fact the exact parallel of many movements that existed in Asia, where it was argued that these colonies, that the societies of these colonies have something very special about them, which is different from the way in which the colonial powers have understood these societies. It is a special quality, a special characteristic, which marks them out as being in many ways superior to the colonial power. And in the Indian case, and in the Indonesian case, and in various other Asian cases, the argument was that these, our societies, have a spiritual quality which makes us different and superior to the colonial power, which is a crass materialist type of power with a crass materialist type of ethic. And consequently, our ethic is spiritual and our ethic is different. This was very much an idea that was written into nationalism at all levels, not just among historians, but among others as well. What of the existing theories of explanation and interpretation did the nationalist historians accept without question? They were extremely sympathetic to Orientalist scholarship. The Orientalists were much praised for their enthusiastic description, particularly of early Indian society. And needless to say, someone like Max Müller emerges as virtually the patron saint of Indian nationalist writing as far as the early period is concerned. The Orientalists are accepted because they glorified Indian civilization. They were extremely sympathetic. What is also interesting is that the nationalist historians totally accepted the theory of Aryan race. There was no question. Here again, I would like to suggest that this theory was so eagerly accepted for two reasons. One was that it linked the past of India with the past of Europe. There is a close connection, it was argued, between ancient India and ancient Greece. And remember, of course, right through the 19th and the early 20th centuries, in fact, in some circles, even now, the civilization of Greece was regarded as the great human miracle. There was something extraordinary among European scholars. They thought there was something extraordinary about the Greek civilization, and it is still frequently referred to as the Greek miracle. Consequently, this linkage with Greece was a very interesting way of saying, well, we were as good as them because in fact we came out of the same roots and we were a parallel tradition to the Greeks. But even more interesting, for the present, for contemporary times, it linked the upper castes of India with the aristocracy of Europe. The argument being, of course, that we're all Aryans, we're all of Aryan stock. The upper castes in India are direct descendants of the pure Aryan races, and the aristocracy of Europe, according to Gobineau, was also the direct descendant of the pure Aryan races. And consequently, the upper castes, who were in fact the ground from which the middle class was recruited, linked themselves very directly with the upper levels, as it was seen, of European society. And my favorite quotation is one that comes from Keshav Chandra Sen, who argues that in the coming of the British to India, this was something of historical momentum because it was the meeting of parted cousins. This really, in a sense, sums up the kind of feeling that existed about the whole question of the closeness of the Europeans to the upper caste. The coming of the British to India was I've forgotten the exact quotation, but what is important is it was a moment of historical importance because it was the meeting of parted cousins. Those that argued against the theory of Aryan race, or argued that the Aryans were foreign and therefore should be regarded as the first amongst the aliens and Aryan institutions should be thrown out, such as Jyotirao Phule, were totally ignored. You get absolutely no mention in any of the histories of this period from the 1920s onwards of the views of those that did not accept the theory of Aryan race. The nationalist school also introduced the idea of the Hindu period being the golden age of Indian history. Again, a very typical reaction. In most nationalisms, it is always the ancient period that is described as the golden period. When you had the height of nationalism in Europe, it was Greece that was described as the golden period. And it makes very good sense, because the further back you go in time, the less evidence you have, the more you can base your interpretation on imagination, the more you can reconstruct the kind of society that you think should go with the golden age, and it's much easier, therefore, to say that that was, in fact, the golden age. And there was resort, of course, to the descriptions of Max Müller talking about passive, non-violent societies and so on. Mill was rejected because, of course, of his extremely nasty statements, particularly about Hindu civilization. But what is interesting, Mill's periodization was totally accepted. The Hindu-Muslim-British periodization was totally accepted, and there was no question of even raising any kind of challenge to this periodization. Nor was there any serious attempt made to try and argue against the existence of such a thing as Oriental despotism. The only major economic history that was developed really on the basis of Dadabhai Nauroji's ideas of the economic drain, that the colonial power was draining India of its financial wealth, and consequently colonialism was therefore disapproved of. But the notion of Oriental despotism was somehow pushed aside and not really taken very seriously. Winston Smith's ideas of golden ages and dark ages were accepted. And the golden ages were, of course, the ages of empire. But Winston Smith's concern with proving everything good and valuable in Indian civilization as being traceable back to the Greeks, this was firmly rejected. Everything was indigenous, and even where there were, in fact, very clear evidences of borrowing from Greek traditions, such as in astronomy and the measurement of time, this was still regarded as something which was a fabrication of European scholars, and there was a tremendous emphasis on indigenous origins. The concentration, however, was on political history and dynastic history. In other words, the narrative of dynasties, in which a great deal was made of earlier dynasties and dynasties which had large kingdoms. Now, I would like to stress that this kind of nationalistic interpretation, this nationalist school of historical writing, was the concern of and was concerned with middle-class identity, middle-class aspirations, and middle-class origins. It was very much the articulation of the new Indian middle-class. And consequently, its continuation, even into the present, is partly because of the fact that there is a continuing aspiration and search for identity of the middle class even to this day. What was the impact of the nationalist school? The first and most important thing is that it started a debate. By questioning the imperialist interpretations of Indian history, it started a debate on a whole series of issues. This is extremely important, and I would repeat what I said yesterday, that history is not a body of information which is passed on from generation to generation. It is an interpretation of the past. And consequently, a debate on the basis of data is absolutely crucial to the advancement of historical knowledge. One cannot remain within the confines of knowledge as it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. In fact, historical information is changing so fast these days that it is necessary that the emphasis be placed on debate and on interpretation. Secondly, it tried to counter the arguments of the imperialist schools, but did not attempt to provide an alternative theory of explanation. It merely took up one point by one point and refuted these points where it was possible to do so. Consequently, the theory of explanation still tended to be either the theory of Aryan race, or when it came to economic history and political history, a tendency for people to continue to talk about Oriental despotism and models of Oriental despotism. Thirdly, the acceptance of Mill's periodization had two results. One was that it acted as a tremendous justification for the two-nation theory in the 30s and the 40s as it emerged in Indian politics, because the argument was that since the beginning of time you've had Hindu civilization and Muslim civilization, therefore you've had a Hindu nation and a Muslim nation, and consequently at independence it makes perfectly good sense to separate the two out, because they have never in fact been one unified nation in the past. As an alternative to this, some secular nationalists changed the nomenclature. Instead of calling it Hindu, Muslim and British, they called it ancient, medieval and modern. Really a rather pointless thing to do, because the divisions remained exactly what they were. The Hindu period was everything in Indian history up till 1206, when the Delhi Sultanate was established. The Muslim period was everything in Indian history from 1206 up to 1757, when the Battle of Plassey took place and the British came along. The East India Company, in fact, came in, but that was regarded as the beginning of British rule. And the modern period, the British period, was the period from then until the present. When I say that it was, in a sense, irrelevant to make this change, what I'm suggesting is that the terms, anyway, ancient, medieval, and modern, are terms that come out of a Christian interpretation of European history and really have nothing to do with Indian history at all. It is the Christian church fathers who in the early modern period in Europe talked about the antique period and the middle period, the Middle Ages and the New Age, and this terminology was then taken up in the hope that somehow the communal terminology of Hindu and Muslim would be forgotten. But of course this didn't happen, because as I said, there was really no attempt to look afresh at the question of periodization and suggest a new periodization. Let me at this point then also briefly consider the question that was raised yesterday. What's wrong with the Hindu-Muslim-British periodization? It seems to make a great deal of sense for Indian history. Let me raise four objections, at least, that historians have, if not many more. First of all, the periodization of Hindu, Muslim and British is one in which, as I said, the Hindu period is everything from Harappan times up to 1206. This is only relevant for a small area of the Ganges Valley, where the Delhi Sultanate was first established. There is no uniform applicability of this chronology throughout the subcontinent. Sindh comes under Muslim rule in the 8th century AD. Punjab and beyond comes under Muslim rule in the 9th century AD. The Deccan comes under Muslim rule much later than 1206 or the 13th century. South India comes under Muslim rule still later. And northeastern India, in fact, doesn't come under Muslim rule. So that it really makes no sense for a subcontinental view of Indian history. Secondly, if one is going to periodize on the basis of the religion patronized by various dynasties, then one also has to talk within the Hindu period, one has to subdivide it and talk about a Buddhist period. Because let us not forget that from the 4th century BC to the 3rd century AD, the major royal patronage and the major royal religions were the shamanic religions of Buddhism and Jainism. They were not the Hindu religions or the major ones I'm talking about. So that makes no sense. But this in a sense is quibbling about chronology and quibbling about titles. The fundamental objections that historians have to this periodization is that it tends, first of all, to take a huge span of time, give it a single label, and deny the fact that there were changes within that span of time. We move from 2800 BC to 1206 AD, a period of what, almost 4,000 years. And we don't accept any change in this, because we say it's all one period. It's all defined by one characteristic, supposedly, that it was dominated by Hindu dynasties. We don't know what the religion of the Harappans was. We don't know how widespread Vedic culture was at a particular period. We do know that there were tremendous supports for shamanic religions. Therefore, how can we define this whole period as being totally conditioned by this label of Hindu? Secondly, and this is in some ways equally important, that the major changes that took place in society throughout the span from 2800 BC right up to the 1930s and 40s, the major changes were not changes that were conditioned by the religion of dynasties. They were changes that were conditioned by much more fundamental features that were taking place in Indian history at the level of society, economy, technology, and all of that, which tied into religious ideology as well. But religion was not, in fact, the basic factor by which change was registered in Indian history. And consequently, by labeling these periods as Hindu, Muslim, and British, one is giving far too much importance to the religious factor to the exclusion of other factors. I mentioned that this periodization of Hindu, Muslim, and British encouraged the communal view of Indian history, and this is something which becomes extremely strong in the 30s and the 40s. That is, that Hindu historians, or those that accepted such a thing as Hindu history, made very sharp distinctions between the Hindu period and the Muslim period, and so also did Muslim historians do the same. Now, the point to understand, of course, is that this communal interpretation of Indian history is not something that existed from 1206 onwards. It is, in fact, something that comes into existence in the 30s and the 40s, at the time when you have communal politics. And once again, it is members of the middle class with communal political affiliations and loyalties searching for identities in the past and insisting that, in fact, the concept of the Hindu nation and the Muslim nation goes back to this early period, right back into the early second millennium AD. So that there is a distinction that has to be kept in mind, that the communal interpretation of Indian history does not go back to the early period. It is the imposition of a modern idea onto an earlier period, and to that extent, the communal interpretation of Indian history is regarded with the same amount of suspicion and doubt as is, for example, the imperialist interpretation of Indian history. Secondly, the communalist interpretation argued that religion was the motivating factor of Indian history, and religion was interpreted in terms of the present-day religion. If one was talking about Hinduism in the 12th century AD, one didn't go back and look at the sources of the 12th century and say, what was Hinduism like in the 12th century? One took the present-day definition of Hinduism and imposed it back onto the earlier period. This is an issue which I will talk about at greater length a couple of days from now, so I won't go into it in detail over here. It was argued on the part of Hindu communalist historians that the only period worth considering was the early period, because that was a period of greatness, the Golden Age. It was argued by Muslim historians that the period before the coming of Islam to India was utterly irrelevant, because it was only when Islam came to India that India came into the world stream of history and became of any relevance to history at all. Another weakness of this school was that there was really no attempt. So when you do that, the historian sitting next to you says, oh, but what about this? You've left these out.
I interpret those facts.
But that is supposed to be more useful than simply set a fact which may be all wrong also.
No, I'm not sure. One is assuming that a historian is an honest historian. I mean, he's not only picking the facts that he wants and he's not only looking for facts, he chooses preconceived conclusions. What he is doing is, as the Tathagata said, history is being completed. Not only in the rather shallow sense that we're getting more and more data, but also because the historian is putting new questions. And as the generation changes, the new generation puts new questions. You put new questions, you look at all the evidence you've got, facts, trends, patterns, oral history, linguistic everything, and then to your questions you reach the answers which the evidence obliges you to believe. But you don't tamper with the facts to suit your conclusion.
Just the last comment, because I have some reason to stop at my
time.
Yes, please. You look at the British historians, the way they look at India, you know, the history of India. Now, for instance, now there is a view, and there is no apology about talking about British historians' angles. Now, is it that there are dishonest historians? I guess there are myself a very honest historian who look at the events that it took place from a particular approach.
No, but you see, when I say honest historian, I would say that the British historian, having got a particular point of view, are looking at facts from that point of view. They should put questions, not come to it with a point of view. In the same way in which I would say that in the pre-47 period, just as the British historians or imperialist historians and saw only such things as they wanted to see, so because of the environment and the context and the circumstances, nationalist historians were also in that sense limited historians, because they were trying to interpret the facts or the evidence such as they had in order to suit certain preconceived conclusions. So one could say that it is only since 1947 that you had a more sophisticated approach to recent history, both from the British side as well as from the Indian side.
I think we will stop now, because I promised Professor Thapar that we would stop at 5 o'clock. She's been speaking continuously, and we must protect her for the next 3 days. Very important.